Why is that? My name is Gene, and I, too, am an alcoholic. And always when I identify myself as an alcoholic, I base that identification on how I interpret the definition of the word alcoholic as is defined in the third chapter of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, wherein it says that we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. And that's all it says. It doesn't make any reference to how much we drank, what we drank, where we drank, or what happened as a result of our drinking. Doesn't say that in order to be an alcoholic, you got to drink wine, live on Skid Row, go to jails and institutions, and marry the same woman 3 or 4 times. Just a decision as to whether or not we have lost the ability to control our drinking. I certainly would be remiss if I didn't thank the committee for inviting me down here, wherever the hell we are. But I don't really mean that. I don't have too much of a kinship with Missouri. About 30 years ago, I spent 7 months on the nut ward up there in John Cochran Hospital in St. Louis, trying to member of the yo-yo squad. They said I was emotionally upset. Only time I was upset was when I run out of booze. That was the only time I got upset. But it's, some people have asked me where Calistoga is, and in reference to a recent Holocaust in San Francisco, I'm a member of the Barbary Coast Men's Stag Group, which is part of the San Francisco Inter-County Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And like you, I consider that the best group in AA. And I live about 60 miles straight north of San Francisco, part of the recent earthquake. And I live in what is generally figured or considered in by many people in California, the most enchanting valley in our state. It's called the Wine Country, the Napa Valley. I could best explain it to you. If any of you see a TV series called Falcon Crest, that's where I live. I live in an area like that, where the only industry in our little 26-mile-long valley is the wine industry. But where I come from, they call winos connoisseurs. And I certainly never had a chance to suck on any of that $90 a bottle stuff. I was more or less down there in our kind of wine, you know. Pride of Lodi, something like that. 80 cents a quart and $8.88 a case. You know, we had dinner tonight next door here in an Italian restaurant, and it was nice. We had a little fellowship. I was scared to death that Jerry was going to ask me to tell you what we talked about at that meeting, at that dinner. That wouldn't, we'd all get run out of here, I think. But as we were eating, I got to thinking of something that I'd like to share with you. It should be obvious to most of you by the size of my belly that I love food. I love food, especially Italian food. As a matter of fact, a few years ago, I gave up sex for food, you know. As a matter of fact, we had a ceiling. We put a mirror on our ceiling in the dining room at home now. But, in this little valley that I live in, the neighboring community is a little town called St. Helena. I live in a little town called Calistoga. There's only 3 little towns in our valley, in our county. And our valley is world-renowned for French and Italian wines and French and Italian food. And that suits me to a T. Some of the finest Italian restaurants in the entire state are located right in our valley. And I have lunch most of the time on the weekdays when I am home. In an Italian restaurant that I and some other gentlemen have been eating in for the last 25 years. And that table set up sort of like this, only it seats 12. And I'm the only member of this group, this fraternity, that doesn't drink. They all know the nature of my business, not that I'm trying to be commercial. I own and operate the an alcoholic treatment facility in Calistoga, California. That is the oldest treatment facility under continuous ownership in California. And it's the first social model detoxification ever done in the United States. And the only program we have is the book Alcoholics Anonymous, so many people know that. And all of these other people around this table are men who are actively engaged in the wine industry. Some of the finest names in the wine industry, Peter Mondavi and Robert Mondavi and Louis Martini and Brother Timothy from the Christian Brothers and guys like that. And we sit around this table, the 12 of us, and we're like little old ladies. You know, we have our own chair, and we get upset if somebody sits in it by mistake. And we have the same two waitresses. They've been there for 25 years, I guess. We don't even order from the menu anymore. They just sort of know what we want, and they bring it, and we don't say nothing. And that's, you know, and it's just a great hour and a half of camaraderie every day. I really look forward to it. And occasionally, some of these wine guys will bring in a visitor from some foreign country, Italy, France, England, Spain, Australia, something. And it just so happens he always winds up sitting alongside of me. Because the table where they have to grab the extra chair from, like over there, to wheel it into our table, and it winds up right alongside of me. Which is fine. And my wine glass is always turned upside down. The waitress just does that automatically because she knows me. Because all of these other guys bring wine to lunch. They bring their fine estate-type wines, and they share with each other their new blends and stuff like that. And my glass is always upside down. So as we sit there eating, inevitably about 15 minutes into the lunch, the stranger will look at me. And he says that inevitable question, "Don't you drink?" I say, "Not today." And that would be fine if he just leave it there. But about 10 minutes later, when you got half a mouthful of tortellini or something, he says, "Why?" Well, I'm not about to get up. Say, "My name is Gene, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm bound by a moral obligation to tell you what it was like, what happened, what it's like now." And so I come up with a couple of them little white lies we tell, you know, and I said, "Well, I'm going to the dentist this afternoon, and, you know, like this alcohol in my breath, or my mother-in-law is coming tonight," or something like that. And I'd done that for a long time, but it always bothered me. Always bothered me. Because, you see, it will be very obvious to most of you shortly that I don't have an education. And explaining my feelings and my thoughts has always been a difficult thing in my life. I know inside of my gut what I want to say, but I really don't know how to say it. And I have known for a long, long time why I don't drink. I know why I don't get up in the morning and put a needle in my arm, roll a joint, to chop a line, or smoke a funny, or whatever the hell my game is, you know. I know why, but I didn't know how to tell you that. And I never used to know how to tell these strangers that. Until a few years ago, I was invited to participate in an AA activity in a place called Stockton, California. Jesus. Now, let me tell you, Stockton is not exactly the French Riviera, you know. Stockton is about as exciting as an empty paint can. Yeah. Big thing in Stockton on Saturday afternoon is to go through the work clothes department of JCPenney's. That's a sort of a big deal around there, you know. And so I was holed up in one of these mama papa type motels waiting for the festivities that night and trying to pass the time of day. And I had the TV turned on and I was watching one of them Saturday afternoon classics, you know, Shirley Temple makes it with Godzilla, or something like that. when all of a sudden the commercial came on. Now, this commercial meant so much to me that I researched it right down to its filming date and everything about it. And it was a nationally syndicated commercial, so I'm quite sure many of you in this room have seen it. And ironically, it was advertising a beer. But it was filmed right in on our most beautiful bay in San Francisco Bay on what I would choose to believe was an October afternoon, because October is the best month, you know, in San Francisco. That is our summer, you know, October. And it was filmed on one of them beautiful days when the bay was just a glistening sheet of blue, you know, and all the sailing boats were out there, looked like a bunch of little white butterflies flitting around, you know. And then they took with the camera, they zoomed in on one of these sailing vessels, these with the big flowing sails, you know, and it showed a bunch of young people running up and down the deck. And they had cut-off blue jeans on and funny little T-shirts and weird little hats, and they were shimmying up the masts and diving off the yardarm, and they swinging on the lines and dropping into the bay, just jackassing around, having a big time. And then the punchline came on for the commercial. It said, "You only go around once. Grab all of the gusto you can." And I didn't know what the hell gusto meant. And I went out to the desk, and I asked if I could borrow a dictionary, and they had a little apartment back in there someplace, and they got me a little dictionary, and I looked up the word gusto. And it says, gusto, slang expression for living. You only go around once. Grab all of the living you can. And it's because of that I didn't put a needle in my arm. I didn't take a drink, and I didn't smoke a funny little cigarette or chop a line this morning. Because I want all of that living I can get. I want to go every place there is to go. I want to see everything there is to see. And I've learned some very cold facts about life. Very cold. Sometimes not really worth repeating, but sometimes necessary to repeat. Did you ever stop to think about life? Life is the most precious thing that you and I or anybody else will ever experience. Life! And from the moment it starts, it begins to get shorter. Every unit of time that goes by, whether it be a minute, an hour, a day, or a week, whatever unit you use, as it goes by, that is a portion of your life that is over, done, finished. In a very morbid way, every unit of time that goes by brings you that much closer to the end of your life. And life isn't a VCR. You can't put it on fast forward, rewind, or anything like that. Life goes by at its pace, not our pace. Its pace. And so I want it all. Damn it, I want it all. But common sense has taught me, and probably has taught you, that we can't get it all. We know that. But how fortunate you and I are. How much more fortunate you and I are than those out there. Because, you see, we know something that they don't know yet. You see, you and I know that we can get more out of life clean and sober than we ever got out of it drinking and using. We already know that. They don't. You and I sit here tonight right where we've been trying to be for years. Or haven't you ever said, Jesus Christ, I wish I had a chance to do it all over again with what I know now. Well, here you are, Charlie. Here you are. Chance to start out all over again. And that's what Bill meant when he defined our program. To start all over again. What is AA? Bill says it, and as Bill sees it, Alcoholics Anonymous is a program designed for people who seek a new way of life. And as a result of taking what we call the fourth step of this program, which most of us took long before we even came to this program, the fourth step, I believe, is what brings us to this program. Because most of us sat alone someplace in a jail or a hospital or your kitchen or your bedroom and said, Jesus Christ, I don't want this to go on. That's the fourth step of this program. And so we're here now to embark on a program. Program sounds too clinical. How about adventure? Embark on a new adventure called living. The great adventure of living. And here we are. Here we are. But a guy asked me as I come in the lobby tonight. He said, hi, Doc. How'd you get here? I got to already say, well, I flew out of San Francisco into Denver and United. Then I went, ho. How did I get here? Me and you started coming here a long time ago. I don't know when you started. I know when I started just about. Let me tell you a little bit about me, you know. As a matter of fact, I was sort of reminded of it. I drove down from our valley over to a town called Santa Rosa yesterday because, as you know, our bridge, the main artery into San Francisco, is busted in half. So transportation getting around right now is a little hectic. And as I was driving through the vineyards and over the mountains in this enchanting place, I came upon a construction site. Now, I was a stonemason by trade for many, many years. I've been retired for a long time. I've spent most of my life in the construction industry. And I still take an interest whenever I go past a construction project, you know, that self-centered, egotistical nature of us. I like to stop by and make sure they're still doing things right, you know, and things like that. Mixing the mortar just right, you know. And as I went past this, this won't mean much to the women in here, I guess, but the guys will understand. It had a big sign out in front, you know, and obviously you can see it was a new school that they were building, and big sign says, Future Home of the Francis W. Pennington High School. Jesus Christ. Can you imagine telling somebody you go to Francis W. Pennington High School? The logo on their football helmets must be a canary, you know? I'm born and raised in a ghetto-like neighborhood in New York, and the high school I went to didn't have a name. It had a number. As a matter of fact, if it had a name, it would have been something like Lucky Luciano Tech or Al Capone Prep, you know. Driver's education in my high school was how to leave the scene of an accident. President of the senior class is a guy by the name of Vito. That ought to tell you everything right there. I had a hell of a time there. Let me tell you about that. I was placed in what the New York State Board of Regents calls special education. Nowadays, they call it Welcome Back Cotter. I stayed in the same room for 8 years. Whatever came first, dating a teacher or smoking, determined if you graduated or not, you know. And finally, I got put out of the eighth grade, and they told me I had to go into the high school. And then the great mystery started. Because the first day I got to high school, they told me that it was a requirement of the New York State Board of Regents that all high school students take a foreign language. I had been getting F in English for 8 years, and now they wanted me to take a foreign language. I sort of entertained the weird thought that if I ever picked up on a language, that's where they were going to ship me, you know. And my older brother Jack was along with me that day, and I can't really recall the choices I had. I think it was French, Spanish, German, and maybe Italian. I don't really remember. But my brother said I didn't have much of a chance in any of them. But I'm a little Irish Roman Catholic, so obviously as a small lad I had served on the altar of the church. So I knew the Latin of the Mass, and I knew the Confiteor and a few things like that. So my brother, wisely, you know, he said, well, you know a little bit about Latin. He says, tell him you'll take Spanish. He says, that's the closest you can get. So as a freshman, I took Spanish 1. And as a sophomore, I took Spanish 1. And as a junior, I took Spanish 1. And in 1940, I was still taking Spanish 1 as a senior when I split from high school. And with the suggestion of 2 detectives from the New York City Police Department, I voluntarily enlisted at age 16 with a fake birth certificate in the United States Marine Corps. And I lost my virginity in a house of ill repute in a place called Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And I learned more Spanish that night than I did in the whole 4 years in high school. I certainly don't tell you that to be vulgar. Because I want to tell you how important that was. That instilled into me, although I didn't realize it at the time, a strong belief in practical experience. A belief that was eventually going to save my life. Because I am totally convinced at this very moment that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous had been anything other than the sharing of experiences between one alcoholic with another. If it had been anything other than that, I'd either be back in the penitentiary, or I'd be dead, or I'd be back there as a piece of crap on Chicago Skid Row, or wherever. If this had been a program where I had to come in here on Monday morning and read chapter 5, and then on Friday answer 30 true or false questions, forget it. Or if I had to read chapter 3 more about alcoholism and then write a 500-word thesis on what the hell I read, forget it. Because I couldn't read anything that had more than 2 syllables in it. And God, as I understand him, placed into my life 3 men. 3 men who sat at tables just like you sit. 3 members of Alcoholics Anonymous who walked the words in that book for me. I couldn't read that book, but those men put those words into motion, and I saw what you meant. I'm not criticizing anybody anywhere in AA. I'm going to tell you just how it was and how I feel. No man in AA that ever worked with me told me to go to 60 meetings in 60 days or 90 meetings in 90 days. They never told me that. What they said was this. We are going to go to 60 meetings in 60 days. We are going to go to 30 meetings in 30 days. You should never, in my opinion, ever let a new alcoholic go to a meeting alone. How is he to know if he's hearing right or wrong if you're not there? 90 meetings in 90 days is a brush off where I come from. In other words, I got no time for you. Get out of my sight for 90 days and then come back and report. And it was through these men that I found this great adventure called Alcoholics Anonymous. But like so many, I stumbled along the way. I'm no shining example of the great success of AA. I came in here when I was 24 years old and stayed drunk for 6 years. Because I was just like the new people today, the young people today. I'm too young to be an alcoholic. My God, I'm only 24 years old. I'm a big-time war hero. How the hell can I be an alcoholic? What, are you taking the fun out of my life? That's what I thought. Hell, I can drink beer, can't I? I just drink on weekends, can't I? There I was being auditioned for the third chapter of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Here are the things that we try, you know. But what possesses people like you and I to become like that? Doesn't it sort of bug you sometime when you run into these people and they say, oh, you don't drink anymore?
No.
Neither do I. Oh, yeah, you on AA? What? What's AA? Well, you said you quit drinking.
Yeah, I just decided to quit.
I must just break them up. The book says that we'll persist, you know, in an illusion, in an obsession, right through the gates of insanity, and it's a death. That we'll participate in countless vain attempts. For what? What the hell are we looking for? What causes us to do these things? I certainly don't know what causes you to do things. And I'm not too sure I know what caused me to do them. But I have sort of a vague idea. Because I don't think we're all that different. I don't care whether you're smoking dope, chopping lines, drinking or what. It's all basically the same. All for the same reason. All for the same reason. Let me offer you this opinion. With me, it started in that recruiting office in 1941. Prior to World War II, the war hadn't started yet, so I don't want you to think I was any big hero out there to defend our shores and all womanhood. I just had a couple of detectives prodding me along, you know. Because I had gotten into the hubcap business and the spotlight business and a few other businesses. And they had given me an alternative. They took me to the federal building at 90 Church Street in New York City. And they said that before you leave this building, one of two things is going to take place. You're either going to voluntarily enlist in some branch of the military, or you're going to be sentenced to a year and a day at Rikers Island, which in those days was New York City and County Juvenile Detention Facility. Now, anybody with any common sense would know you're better off in the military than going to a reform school. So I accepted my fate. And I wound up being interviewed by a Marine. What a big interview that was. I think he held it in the broom closet. You know, he didn't even turn on a light. He just let the light shine in from the hall. He said, I got to give you an eye test. And he hung up this big chart, you know. And he said, put that over your right eye. Tell me what you see. And I went, he says, fine. Just like that. I'd been interviewed by the Navy prior to that, and just to show you the kind of an asshole I was. I was a 16-year-old wise-ass street punk. I would have jack-rolled my grandmother if I knew she had a quarter. I lied and I cheated and I shot every angle I could, and I figured the world owed me a living, and today was payday. That was the kind of an attitude that they brought into this Navy recruiting office. The first guy I saw was the chief yeoman. Boy, I could see him as plain as day, sitting right out there in the middle of this big office, you know. You ever see a chief yeoman in the Navy? They look like ambulance drivers, you know. They had the black coat on, the black tie, big fuzzy little cheekies are all in red, you know, and they got that crew cut in their teeth. They look like they come from Iowa, you know. And before I gave him a chance to speak, I told him that if I went into the Navy, what ship I wanted to be on, and a few other things, and he got upset about that, you know. And he expressed, you know, his disgust with me in some nautical terms, which I didn't really understand, you know. And when he got through, I expressed a few viewpoints of my own in some street terms, which really upset him. He came out from behind that desk, and man, he must have hit me 5,000 times, you know, before I kissed the floor. And when I came to, this should be easy for those of you who are alcoholics. And I came to out in the corridor. I was laying on my back. And as I shook myself into some semblance of reality and my eyes opened up, I was staring straight up. And right over me looked like the tallest guy I'd ever seen in my life. Looked like he was 19 foot 11, you know, from that angle. He had on them royal blue trousers and a red stripe up the side and then dark blue and a yard and a half of crap up here and red and yellow all over here. Looked like Wallace Beery, you know. And he said, "Hello, tough guy." I didn't think I was tougher, but I figured as long as that jackass did, you know. I thought he played in a band. I didn't know who the hell he was, you know. And he turned out to be the Marine recruiter. But that night, you know, if I was somebody engaged, you know, in the field of alcoholic treatment and things like that, I would diagnose it, I would say this to you. That what I'm about to tell you was the beginning of the development of the alcoholic personality, you know. Because that night I got put on a train in Penn Station with six other guys who had enlisted in the Marines that day. But they weren't 16-year-old fuzzy-cheeked little wimps like me. I called them old guys. They were probably 18, 19 years old. But they were big guys. They were 6'2". They had the big shoulders. They were the kind of guys you see in the Marine pictures on TV, you know. John Wayne, Victor McLaughlin, all them Ty Hard and all them big guys, you know. And I was on a train with six of them. And I was streetwise enough to know to keep my mouth shut, you know. And I just sat there in total awe of these guys. Total awe. Because one of them, and this won't be no big deal to those of you who live here in the West, one of these guys was a real cowboy. I had never seen a cowboy in my life. The only guy I'd ever seen on a horse in my life was a New York cop, you know. And here this guy is sitting there, and he was a real cowboy. He wasn't one that just bought the clothes, you know. He had a dirty old hat and big buckles, you know, and worn-out shoes. And he talked that cowboy talk, you know. Roping and fencing and things like that. And as he was talking, man, I just was taking it all in. And right in the middle of his talk, he kept talking away, and he pulled out a little bag and fooled around like that and some paper. And son of a bitch made a cigarette with his hand. I had never seen anything like that in my life. My God! Oh, I wanted to be him. Jesus, I wanted to be a cowboy. I wanted to make a cigarette with my mouth. I wanted to rope. I wanted to ride the range. I wanted all the things, you know. But I only wanted to be that until somebody else started to talk. And the next guy was sort of a liar because at first he said he was with the circus. What he really was, he was a stagehand with a burlesque show that traveled around with a carnival. But it didn't take a lot of thinking on my part to realize that if he's a stagehand in a burlesque show, that means he is backstage when the stripteasers get finished there. Wow! Now, I know topless is no big deal today in our permissive society. But come on. In 1941, for a 16-year-old virgin, man, that was the deep throat of my day. And I wanted to be him. Only until the next guy. The war was half over before I figured this out. I was on some lousy island out in the Pacific, I guess, one day, and I went, oh. Because this guy was a merchant seaman. And he had enlisted in the Marines that day under a fictitious name. Because he was trying to duck whatever kind of punishment he was going to get in the maritime service. Because he said he had lost his ship in Manhattan. For 2 years, how the hell do you lose a ship? You know, big ship, you know. But what was so exciting about him, it's just a week prior to being there on the train with me, he had been in a place called Reykjavik, Iceland. Holy Christ. You know, up till that day, my entire world was 40 square city blocks. I knew every rooftop, every manhole, every alley in that 40 square blocks. But outside of that, everything was totally alien to me. I could look across the Hudson River, and I knew New Jersey was over there someplace. And I knew that if you went on up through the Bronx and up and through Westchester, you'd eventually come to someplace called Connecticut. I knew that. And I had never been out of my little cocoon. And now I was on my way to a place called Parris Island, South Carolina. I thought Indians were still down there for all I knew. And I'm with a cowboy. And I'm with a guy that just came back from Reykjavik, Iceland. And a guy from the circus. My God, I'm a world traveler, you know. And the train hadn't even left the station yet. Check yourself. If you sat on that train with me that night, you would have thought the same thing I thought. I want to be those guys. I don't want to be a 16-year-old wimp. I want to be a cowboy. I want to be in a circus. I want to be something other than what the hell I am. And I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know how to do it. At 16, what the hell? But after we left Penn Station, through some process of selection, we had a layover in Washington, D.C. And we pooled whatever change we had amongst us together. And whoever we selected made a speed run in Washington, D.C. and went downtown and come back on the train with a shopping bag full of booze. I have no idea to this day what kind of booze it was, how much it was. It doesn't make a hell of a lot of difference. But that night I drank. And that night I got drunk. And it was the greatest night in my young life. God, it was phenomenal. I didn't shoot a cop. I didn't have a convulsion. I didn't have seizures or DTs. Jesus, it was fantastic. I was one of the guys. I was one of the guys. I remember walking into the dining car when that gentleman came to serve me my evening meal. I looked him square in the face. I said, "You know who I am?" And he said, "No, no." And I says, "I'm a rodeo star, and I just come back from Cheyenne, Wyoming." And a little while later, I told a little old lady sitting there who didn't give a damn who the hell I was. I told her I was an aerialist with the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus. And someone helped me into the berth that night. And I told him I was the first mate on a ship that had just come back from Reykjavik, Iceland. I discovered the magic, just like you discovered it. As long as I can get a little of that stuff inside of me, I could play any role that I wanted to play. It didn't mean a damn to me whether you believed it. I believed it. I believed I was the cowboy. I believed I was in the circus. Who, what the hell you believe? That's how it was going to be for a number of years. Oh, I got a warning right off the bat. We all had warnings, but we don't heed them, I guess. I got mine the very next morning. I don't know if any of you have ever been down south. You would never believe the place where they stopped a train that takes the Marine recruits to this godforsaken place called Parris Island. It's a place called Port Royal. I don't even know why the hell I ever gave it a name, because there is nothing there. It's in the middle of a swamp. Big swamp. All them trees, I don't know what the hell you call them. They look like they're dead, you know, all that crap hanging down and things flying through there like that. And all you can see coming up out of the water is the top of the railroad tracks, you know. And it's hot up here and cold down here, so it sort of steams. Looks like where Dracula would hang out, you know. And I don't know if the Marines do that on purpose for psychological reasons or what, but they bring that damn train in there at 5 a.m. You know, you don't know whether it's nighttime, daytime, is it going to get light or dark. It's very confusing, especially if you have a hangover. And, man, I'm experiencing my first hangover. Man, I want to die. I'm sicker than 20 sailors at Pearl Harbor, you know. I want to throw up, and I can't throw up, and I'm freezing to death, and I'm sweating, and I'm shaking, and bells are ringing. My neck is heavy. Oh, I want to die, you know. And I stepped down off of this train into that water, And that's when I saw the first real Marine that I was to see. I see him right now. Right now I see this guy. Coming out of that fog, you know. I would have been better off with Dracula, believe me. And he didn't have on one of them blue and red outfits with all of that other crap up there. No, he was about 5'8". And he was 5'8". Every way you looked at him, he was 5'8". You know. And he had no neck. His head came right out of his chest. I was bright red. And he wore one of Smokey the Bear hats. And he walked like he had a bad leg. And he came right up to me. And I'm telling you, I'm sick, right? I don't know why the hell he picked on me, but I was dressed in the style of my day, and this guy definitely didn't understand style. Because in 1941, I don't know what the hell the style was in Springfield, Missouri, but in New York City, we wore pants that were very tight at the cuff, and you couldn't get your pants off unless you took your shoes off. The belt line came way up around here someplace. You wore a coat down below your knees with padded shoulders and a hat with a brim out to here and a watch chain down. You called them zoot suits. And that's what I had on. Now, this guy must have been from the southeast someplace. You know, they talk funny down there anyhow. Definitely didn't understand style. Because he threw his face right up into mine playing chinny chin chin, you know, and hat spitting and slobbering all over my face. He hollers out, "Well, I guess we got another one of them New York slickers here." Jesus Christ, that hair went right through my head. It was like somebody took a javelin and threw you. Oh, my God. And you know what alcoholic rage is. That's when your actions overrule your common sense, you know. And I haul off and whack this guy, you know. Not the way to go into any branch of the military. I spent the first 72 days of my Marine Corps career in the Paris Island brig, you know. But God in his infinite wisdom finally let me out, and I went on overseas. And I was overseas when all hell broke. And I joined the Japanese program, and they kept us over for a while. And everything was fine. I don't know when I became an alcoholic. I don't really know about that day when you cross over that invisible line, you know. There were days early in my drinking when I thought I was in a lot of trouble from drinking. And later on, there were times when I didn't think I was in trouble, so I don't really know. But as a construction worker, I worked all over the Middle West here. Worked many times in Missouri, here in Louisiana, in Chicago area. And anybody that's been in that business knows what it's like. You're out of town and you act like a bunch of idiots, like a bunch of little kids, and you're drinking up a storm every night and raising hell, and your values change a little bit. And we called it fun. We called it fun. I was watching a little biography of Vince Lombardi, the Green Bay Packers coach, just before I came down to the meeting, and reminded me of it. I worked on that stadium up there in Green Bay for the Green Bay Packers. And we were living in a place called the Northland Hotel, away from home, you know, 2 weeks at a time, and getting drunk every night and raising hell. And our idea of fun in those days, when you come to work on a Monday morning, you know, you got a patch over your eye, you're sucking soup out of a straw, you got 3 stitches in your upper lip, you got an IOU for a restitution in the restaurant downtown and a warrant for your arrest. And you're saying to the guy alongside of us, "Jesus Christ, Bruce, you should have been with us. We had a hell of a time this weekend." We thought that was fun. Thought that was fun, you know. And then your values change. I wouldn't stand here tonight and bore you with a blow-by-blow description of what happened to me. But I would think it would be important for any of you who were in here and new to hear one statement. If I had time to tell you of all of the so-called pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization that became part of my life, I would want you to know this. It all happened after I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came here wedding white, but a clean bill. I had never been in jail, never been sick, never threatened with a divorce, never had lost a job in my life. I wound up at my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because of a rather silly thing in your neighboring state here. We were building a shopping center in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And so my job would take me home to northern Illinois at that time. just on the weekend. And on Monday morning, I'd start back up to Milwaukee. And halfway point for me was Beloit, Wisconsin. And I'd gotten in a habit of stopping in a little hotel there called the Hilton Hotel, but it wasn't a real Hilton. And I used to get there about 5 after 6, because I knew the Swamper would be coming in about that time. I'd be his only customer, and he got to know me. And I had started to drink in the morning. But honestly, this is going to sound like a cop-out, but I don't believe I was drinking alcoholically. It was winter time, and it was cold in Wisconsin. And most of the guys who were all working outside at this time always used to put a couple of belts into the thermos bottles. And the roofers were working there, and the roofers would throw their tar on, they'd have a little wine, all under the premise of staying warm, staying warm. And I had gotten into that habit. I had a quart thermos, and I would bring it into this hotel, and this guy would pour 2 shots of booze into it for me. As long as I was there, I'd have one too, you know, and get a pack of cigarettes or something like that. But that was it. Until this one morning I walked in there, and I wasn't alone. There were 3 ladies of the evening and 2 salesman-type guys at the bar, right in the middle of a big party. You could tell that. They'd been partying for a couple of days, feeling pretty good. And I went right down to my end of the bar. I had my work clothes on. And before I could even say anything, bang, a shot went right up in front of me. And bartender Fritz, he said, "That's on the guy up there in the blue suit." "It's you, friend." And I drank it. I put it down. Bang, he filled it right back up again. "He's that's on the guy in the gray suit." "Here's to you, friend. And give them a drink back. Or you'll fill me up, too." Now, it didn't take any brains on my part to know what they were trying to do. There was 2 guys there with 3 women. They needed help, you know. They needed somebody. Yeah, I knew that. And I don't care what the intellectuals say, and I don't care what the shrinks say and all of that. I know why I didn't drink that morning, or why I did drink, because I knew I'd have more fun not drinking, or more fun drinking than I would if I didn't drink. I knew it was party time! It wasn't because I was emotionally upset or emotionally immature. It was because I wanted to screw around. And that's why most of us drink. That's why me. But you try to tell that to one of these psychiatrists. "Hey, why do you drink, son?" "Because I like to screw around." "Get out of here, you wise guy." Let me tell him the truth. Well, we took off, and I woke up in Ames, Iowa. On a Thursday in I didn't even know if it was still there, an Amish colony, with the executive secretary of the Parker Pen Company in Janesville, Wisconsin. To this day, she don't know my name, and I don't know her name, and I don't know what the hell we were doing in Ames, Iowa. But that was what brought me to AA. Because that Friday, and you construction guys will know this, we're all sitting around at lunchtime, guys sitting on scaffold plank piles of brick, talking, shooting a bull, telling little stories, and I'm up there holding court, and I was the foreman. And they're all listening to me, and I'm telling them about this great escapade, this fun we had. And they're all laughing at me, you know, and having a lot of fun. Except one guy. One guy. A guy by the name of Eddie Friel from Dixon, Illinois. About 2:30 that afternoon, I'm sitting in the shanty. Make you believe I'm looking at the prince, I guess. And I see Eddie coming down the scaffold, down the ladder. He comes right into the shanty with me. And he says, "Boomer," he says, "can I talk to you?" And I says, "Sure, Ed, what do you want?" He says, "Boomer," he says, "I'm an alcoholic." And he says, "I belong to AA." And then he said the greatest words that any sick alcoholic can ever hear. He said, "Would you like to go to a meeting?" My God. My first reaction was to get something in my hand and move his face around. I was furious! "My God Almighty, what the hell are you talking about? A meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? I wanted to pull his skin right out of his bones." Now, I know that we have a spiritual awakening only after taking 11 steps. But certainly there are spiritual things that take place in our lives. Because that instant, full of anger, full of rage, at full denial, I mustered them words of hate down in my gut and mixed them with all of the venom and poison I knew and brought them up slowly and mustered them in my mouth to spit right in his face. And when it came out, it said yes. Now, I believe this. That day, even if I had thought I was an alcoholic, I wouldn't have come to AA. I wouldn't have thought I needed to go to AA. I wouldn't have wanted to go to AA. But yet I said yes. And it couldn't have been me who said those words. I know that. It couldn't have been me. And the same thing would take place a few years later in the parking lot of an institution. Because the man who was going to become my sponsor, I hated. And I had been listening to him for 6 years, him and his crappy AA friends. And then one night I said something I thought I'd never say. I said, Bob, would you be my sponsor? And I stood there waiting for the big hug. And he said, no. I could have killed him right then and there. But he was wise. Because he said, Duff, I want you to think it over for a week. Because I'll tell you tonight what it's going to be like if I'm your sponsor. He said, if I'm your sponsor, I'm going to make every decision in your life for the next year without any question or comment from you. Because you're really sick. And I told him what you would have told him. I'm not going to repeat it here either in front of the ladies. But I went back to my unit, and I went through the toughest week that I ever went through in my life. Because I knew he was right. And I was in direct conflict with myself. I knew I was wrong, and I knew he was right, but we were going to do it my way. And we call that self-will, run riot. And I changed my mind probably 50 times that week, and I went back over there the next Sunday night to tell him what the hell he could do at AA. And I got him out there in that parking lot, and I got all them words mixed up down in my gut, mixed them up with that poison and that venom, and brought him up here and got ready to spit him right in his face. And when it came out, I said, will you be my sponsor? I didn't want to say that. I didn't mean to say that. And it was because of him and two other guys, Ozzy and Ray. They walked me through the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I can remember that time when I was trying to read and I came to that part about pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. My God, big words like that. And I asked Ozzy, old seasoned warhorse type guy, you know, the kind of a guy that if you were backed up in an alley and you needed some help, he'd be the guy you'd want with you, you know. And Ozzy never said much, but he could say enough in two words, and that was enough. And I said, Ozzy, I don't know what the hell them words mean. And he said, just keep going to the meetings, you know. And then one night we were sitting at a meeting, and a woman got up, you know, and she was telling her story, and she told horrible things that had been part of her life physically and how she'd been abused as a result. And Ozzy just looked at me and he says, that's physical. That's incomprehensible demoralization right then and there. And every time that he would hear something like that, he'd say, that's the demoralization. And then I learned what we all have to learn. That if that book is true, and as it says, if we keep persisting in these insane illusions, and insane is the correct word, think for a moment. Think for a moment. And I don't want to put a damper on your festivities here, but reality is reality. We can't be so naive in this room here tonight to accept the fact that everybody in this room is finished drinking. You know, and I know, that that is not true. That there are people in this room who will drink and use again. And that's not no wish of mine. They wrote that in that book 53 years ago. And they didn't even know you. Or maybe you haven't gotten that far in the book where it says, despite all that we can say, many who are real alcoholics, by every form of self-deception and experimentation, will try to prove themselves deceptive to the rule. But the scary thing about that returning to drinking proves that people like you and I are capable of making an insane decision while we're sane. Because if you drink again, you're going to decide to do that when you're sober. And that's why we come to meetings like this. That's why we answer phone calls in the middle of the night. That's why we go to San Quentin on Thursday nights and Folsom on the third Sunday of every month and go down to Soledad the last Friday of every month to continue to remind yourself that at any moment in your life, you are capable of making that insane decision. And for a while now, I haven't made them decisions. And I did what those men told me to do, many times in total disagreement, times when I hated them. But I've always been told that the sign of a good sponsor is somebody you probably dislike early. Because a good sponsor undoubtedly will be telling you things you don't want to hear. And he'll be telling you to do things that you don't want to do. And he'll be telling you to go places you don't want to go. And mine certainly were like that. But I lived and I survived. And I got to be there that moment to take this gift, this thing that you and I have. This great gift of life. Of life. My God almighty. That's what you and I give each other. Hey, big deal out in California. They transplant hearts. Big deal. Down in UCLA, they transplant kidneys. Big deal. Up there in Michael Reese Hospital, Chicago, National Eye Bank, they transplant eyes. Now, I'm not mocking them. Those are great feats of surgery done by great, educated, dedicated people. But they don't match what me and you do. Me and you, what do we call the outcast of the world? The lowly drunk? Me and you, by a simple thing like Eddie said to me, would you like to go to a meeting? He not only gave me my heart, my eyes, and my kidneys, he gave me the whole ball of wax. And you give him the ball of wax, too, when you say, would you like to go to a meeting? Here's your life. Here's your life. Take your life. But sometimes we feel, I shouldn't say we. I felt I didn't belong. I said that I wouldn't tell you everything that happened to me, and I certainly won't, because some of the scars are still deep and some of the shame is there. And I thought for a long time in AA that I didn't really belong amongst you. I had deserted a family, and I had done a lot of rotten, scummy things. And I had a hell of a time reaffirming any kind of faith in a God as I understand it. I have always known about God. That was no problem. I was born and raised in a good Christian home and a good Christian mother, educated for a while in the parochial school system. So I have always never denied the existence of God. My problem was always having a strong belief that this God does have these powers, that if I do turn my life and will over, that something will happen. I couldn't believe that. Because I thought God would say, why, you're here? Get out of here, you know, scumhead. And so I tried to stay in this great adventure on a one-step program. Boy, that's worse than being drunk. And my original sponsor, who's passed away, was one of the founding members of AA in Chicago. And he was often asked to go around and speak at different places, but in his latter years, he was going blind. So he always had to take somebody with him to get him on and off the planes and get him through terminals and stuff like that. And he would often take one of the guys he was sponsoring. And he took me with him to Corpus Christi, Texas, to the top of Texas Roundup, about 30-odd years ago. And I was a little bit peeved because I had some friends from the Marine Corps who lived in Corpus Christi, and I wanted to look them up on Friday night. And he said, no, we're going to the meeting. And I said, hell, you don't speak till tomorrow night. He said, that don't make nothing. We're going to go to all the meetings. So I went over there full of resentment. And the guy that was speaking that night was a guy by the name of Talbot Haygood from Richmond, Virginia. And I'm sitting there, you know, in my pity pot full of self-pity, bitter, half hearing what the speaker's saying, and then all of a sudden Talbot said, I had an awful time reaffirming my faith in the God as I understand him. And then my head went up like the rooster in the hen house. Yeah, me too. Me too. And Talbot told a little story that I have told all over the world because it brought me into this program. It taught me about God as I understand him. Talbot told about the sharecropping family that lived not too far from here in Georgia, of all places. Georgia. My God. Trying to make a living out of the soil in Georgia. If you've ever been in Georgia, you know that's got to be a tough task. Because Georgia is nothing but that red, ugly clay. But this family, each year, would plant their crops. And through some miracle, they would get something at the end of the year that they could harvest and bring in. But it would only furnish them with enough money to go on for another year. They never had any of the luxuries and the things that you and I sort of take for granted nowadays. They just made it, just made it. Until one year, after everything was bought and paid for and the crops were in, they discovered they had a $5 bill left over. And they were extremely joyous because they had never had anything like that before. So in their happiness, they decided, wisely of course, that $5 really wasn't enough to buy each member of the family a gift, that they should just buy one gift so that the entire family could share it together. And after some kind of deliberation, they decided to buy a mirror. This family had never owned a mirror. No one in that family had ever seen his or her own true self. They all knew the beauty in each other, but no one had ever known his own image. So it was a very exciting day, the day that the package arrived. And they gathered in the kitchen around the table, and out of respect to the father, they let him as the head of the family be the first to look into the mirror. Now, he knew the beauty in his wife and in his daughter and his little son. And when he looked into the mirror and saw himself for the first time, he did exactly what mature elderly men would do. He blushed a little, and he smiled, and he fooled with the strap on his overalls and gave his nose a couple of pokes, you know. Then he turned and he smiled and he handed it to his wife, who knew the beauty in her husband and her children. And when she saw herself for the first time, she too did exactly what mature elderly women would do. She smiled and fixed her specs and trimmed the back of her hair and fooled with the collar on her house coat and blushed a little bit. And then turned and handed the mirror to her teenage daughter, who was an extremely beautiful girl, and who knew all of the beauty in her parents and in her brother. And like any teenage girl, when she saw herself for the first time, she giggled and tee-heed and fooled with the curls in her hair and little ribbon and giggled some more and blushed. And then turned and handed the mirror to her little 7-year-old brother, who knew all of the beauty in his family. Now, her little brother, when he had only been 1 year old, he had been standing alongside of his daddy while his daddy was milking a cow. And the cow had kicked out and struck that little boy right in the face. And what was supposed to have been a little boy's face was nothing more than a twisted, ugly mess. Ghoulish, ugly. When that little child looked into that mirror and saw what was supposed to be his face, he was totally confused. He didn't understand. And he went immediately to his mother. And he says, Mother, I don't understand. He says, but Mama, how can you love me when I'm so ugly? And she said what any mother would say. Because you're mine. And that's the relationship that I have now with the God as I understand him. For you see, he besides myself is the only other person who has known me and my total ugliness. When my family, with just cause, had to turn away from me because of my ugliness. But my friends also with just cause had to turn away because of that ugliness. I stood no different than many of you. My back was to the wall. And I was a little boy who was confused. And I didn't know what to do. And in the three pertinent ideas that are read in that portion of the fifth chapter of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, the second and third of those ideas told me what to do. Because standing there in my ugliness, you said this: we believed that no human power can relieve your alcoholism. But God could and would if he were sought. And I sought this God as you directed me to, through prayer and through meditation. And one day he selected one of you to come forward and carry the gift of sobriety to me. And you told me that day that I should take that gift, that precious gift, that gift of sobriety and life. And you said, bring it close to you and protect it with your life, because it is your life. And as you hold it close to you, take from it its strength, its hope, its compassion, its love. And if you'll just do some of those things sooner than you expect, and certainly much sooner than you deserve, you'll be able to stand up and walk once more amongst your fellows. And on that day that you can stand up and walk once more with some semblance of dignity back in your life, we'll ask you only to bring that gift back. Thank you very much for having me here. Thank you.